The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Hooten, Judge Smith, Judge Smith, the Honorable Carol A. Hooten presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This matter is being recorded, it is obviously a virtual proceeding this morning. And the first matter we're going to call is A-20-1481, Christopher Welters versus the Minnesota Department of Corrections. Counsel, you will each have 15 minutes for your oral argument. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself and your client prior to beginning your oral argument. And with that being said, we will now proceed with the appellant.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Zorislav Lederman. I represent Mr. Welters. He was a plaintiff in the district court. He's the appellant here. As the court is aware, this is a civil rights case that was dismissed by the district court, and we're asking the court to reverse and remand the claims for trial. There were a number of claims at issue here. We have the handcuffing injury, then we have the inmate assault incident, and also the negligence claims that were brought under state law.
Can I start with the Eighth Amendment claim that you yes. have brought? What is our standard of review on that? What is it necessary for you to show? Because it seems to be a dispute between you and this and the Minnesota Department of Corrections as to the appropriate standard. They're claiming right. it has to be malicious and conduct, and you're claiming it has to be. How is that worded?
Deliberate indifference.
Deliberate indifference. Thank you. That's exactly what I want to say.
Yes, and I plan to focus kind of quite a bit of my argument on this issue today because it's important to figure out which standards to apply.
Well, and I was a little surprised. It seemed like that's where we should have started this whole discussion that we've been having. So
yes.
Please proceed.
I will talk about that. So there are these two separate standards. We have the malicious and sadistic use of force standard, and we have the deliberate indifference standard. Our position is that the deliberate indifference standard should apply in this case, and I'll explain why.
Let me ask, before you go there, would you agree that if it's a malicious standard that you would fail in your proof?
No, Your Honor, we disagree with that, and especially with respect to Officer Roney, who initially handcuffed Mr. Welters. Our position that even under that standard, that the cuffs were applied maliciously, he knew about it. He clicked the cuffs, and then they were tightening before they left. So in our view, even under the higher standard, there's still a fact issue with regards to that officer. I'll go back and talk about the two standards. This is a federal claim, so federal law will control here, and the court should look to this case that we cite, Jackson versus Gutzmer. In that case, the Court of Appeals, this is the Eighth Circuit now, the court there explained clearly that when there is a dispute about which standard to apply, the reviewing court has to look at the facts very carefully to decide whether this is a use of force incident or is this a condition of confinement incident. Now, the terminology used in that case was the use of passive restraints. So just based on that term, one thing we should look at, is this an incident where we have passive use of restraints versus active use of restraints? Here, this is passive because there was simply no need to handcuff Mr. Welters because of anything he had done. This was purely an administrative handcuffing per DOC policy. Some other things the court should look at is whether the handcuffing was done for the purposes of confinement or for the purposes of restraining. And again, this is simply a confinement case because he did not need to be restrained out of any sort of safety issue or some kind of a prison fight that broke out or a security issue. This was simply to move him from one place to another per DOC policies.
Counsel, let me interrupt you if I may for a second. Here's what my question about this. I mean, the deliberate indifference standard comes out of, I think, the case law out of, you know, ignoring an inmate's medical needs or their injury or so on, right? I think that's the the case law is. I mean, if you're suggesting that the reason for the restraint should be that is what triggers the legal standard. I don't think it's technically a standard of review. That's like usually appellate review. I think it's the legal standard that applies in the case. If the legal standard is excessive force standard versus deliberate indifference standard, I think you're suggesting that if you have two inmates that are being transported at the same time, one, you have concerns about flight risk because that person has, you know, whatever, done that in the past, et cetera. The other person, you don't. Is that the way that those two inmates would be treated in the same medical transport, there'd be two different legal standards that applied based on whether that particular inmate was considered a flight risk or not, or a safety risk. And that seems kind of problematic in the you know, performance of the officer's duties and choices that they make. Can you speak to me about that?
Yes, Your Honor. I would with respect disagree with that assessment. In my view, and in the appellant's view, we should still apply the conditions of confinement standard to both of these inmates, even though one poses a flight risk and the other one doesn't. And the reason for that is, again, the inmate who poses a flight risk, he hasn't done anything during that particular incident to be handcuffed. He may have done something previously. He may be just considered a higher risk in terms of DOC's classification. But again, there was nothing that happened with regards to both of these inmates that would necessitate handcuffing either one of them, that they're being handcuffed simply for policy because that's what the policy requires for general safety, as opposed to something that either of them have done individually to cause being handcuffed.
Okay, so under your reading of it, that medical transport is the officer's actions are evaluated under the deliberate indifference standard, unless those inmates had done something specific to pose a safety or safety risk. Is that it?
Exactly right. Yeah.
And what's your authority for that proposition that restraint sort of as a matter of practice during a medical transport would be subject to that standard?
Sure. The authority, again, Your Honor, is the Jackson versus Glitzmer case. You know, it doesn't go through various, you know, hypotheticals of when do you apply one standard versus the other. But that case makes clear that if the standard is challenged, then the reviewing court has to figure out which standard to apply. And obviously, given the fact that there are two standards, I mean, if there is only one standard available, then this wouldn't be an issue for discussion.
Right. The district court actually, in fact, needs to determine what standard applies. The district court is the one that needs to apply it in the first instance. We do de novo review because it's summary judgment. So we both should apply the same standard. And you're saying that Jackson, which is that, I assume that's the Eighth Circuit case on a inmate who is in labor, right?
Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
You're saying that in all cases, even if you're not in labor, an inmate's not in labor, if you're medically transporting, that case holds that if you're medically transporting an inmate for any purpose, dental work, ankle, EKG, et cetera, that's subject to the deliberate indifference standard. Is that it?
We would argue that yes, if you take what that case says about how do you decide which standard to use, if you're using restraints simply to transport an inmate for a medical visit, to transport inmates between facilities, that the conditions of confinement standard applies because we're restraining the inmate to confine them as opposed to using force against them because of some sort of security risk that they pose specifically based on their actions. I also want to address something else that Your Honor mentioned with regards to the deliberate indifference standard coming out of medical cases. In our view, with respect, that's also inaccurate. Farmer versus Brennan, for example, this is a Supreme Court case. There are many medical cases that the deliberate indifference standard is applied to, but there is a whole separate subset of cases dealing with issues where prison staff disregard a substantial risk of harm. And for example, as applicable to this case, we have situations of risk of inmate assault. The deliberate indifference standard applies there as well. Failing to protect transgender inmates, for example, from being sexually abused and harassed within prisons. The deliberate indifference standard applies there as well. So it's not just a medical standard, It's a general risk of harm standard. It's prudent staff disregarding a general risk of harm.
Okay. Can I ask you under your, thank you, that is helpful. What if the transport was for a non-medical purpose here? Any other purpose that they're being inmates are being transported? Is the are the restraints then, are the officer's conduct subject to a deliberate indifference standard when it's transportation for another purpose?
Your Honor, as long as the inmate is being transported for medical reasons, just being transported to a different facility, being transported to court, for example, if they have to take somebody to court, in our assessment, the deliberate indifference standard should apply to all those sorts of situations because the inmate hasn't done anything to cause a security concern. He's simply being handcuffed to bring him from one place to another because that's what the DOC policy requires as a condition of confining their inmates. They don't have a choice that they handcuff everyone. It doesn't matter if you're a high-risk inmate, if you're a low-risk inmate, or if you're about to be released tomorrow, they're going to handcuff you anyway for general security reasons, notwithstanding your personal history. And that's why this use of force standard is not applicable here, because Mr. Walters hadn't done anything to be handcuffed. He was simply going to Oak Park Heights, which is even a higher security facility than Stillwater, for a medical procedure.
So that's helpful. You would have any restraint case during transport for any purpose subject to the deliberate indifference standard unless that individual posed a specific risk, safety risk.
Right,
and that needs
right.
to be evaluated as a violation of clearly established rights if an officer doesn't evaluate the individual risk that the inmate poses. Is that
yes.
right?
Yes.
Okay.
And just to give an opposing example, if Mr. Walters, for example, let's just bring the incident when he got assaulted by the other inmate. In that situation, if the officer showed up and they handcuffed him in response to the fight with the other inmate, that would be the kind of scenario where the excessive force standard would apply because now he's involved in a physical altercation. He's being handcuffed because of his specific involvement in the fight with the other inmate. This is where you would apply the sadistic and malicious standard. And again, this is all consistent with federal case law. It looks like I only have about 3 minutes left, so I'll just move on perhaps here and talk about the negligence claim. That's kind of the other important issue in this case. The district court, Your Honor, is correct to determine that Officer Roney doesn't get official immunity because he, at least under Mr. Walters' facts, he violated DOC policy, had a ministerial duty to double lock the cuffs, and he didn't do that. The problem with the district court's decision goes to the issue of causation. And the district court determined that that Mr. Walters had failed to raise a genuine issue of fact for trial on the element of causation with regards to Officer Roney. A couple issues here. First of all, under Minnesota state law, causation is determined based on the substantial factor test. So the question is, was the defendant's conduct a substantial factor in causing the injury? And so if we look at the facts here, Officer Roney handcuffed Mr. Walters before they left Stillwater. Mr. Walters complained. Officer Roney checked the cuffs. He heard them click and tighten. So he knows now that the cuffs are not double locked. He doesn't fix them before they leave, and he also doesn't fix them when they get to Oak Park Heights. And so clearly there is a fact issue with regards to whether his conduct was a substantial factor in the ultimate injury of Mr. Walters' nerve damage. And then we also have the expert affidavit that was submitted in this case by Dr. Melitu, who also confirmed that it was the excessive and over-tightened cuffs being applied for a prolonged period that resulted in Mr. Walters' nerve damage. And so once again, we have a factual dispute here with regards to what caused the injury. And then finally, the element of causation is always a question for the jury. There are cases where this can be resolved on summary judgment. But those would be cases where there is simply no dispute about the fact that the defendant was not responsible for the injury. I think the district court's issue here was that the district court decided that that we couldn't figure out whether it was Officer Roney or Officer Emily that contributed to the injury. Now, our view is that they both did. And even if Officer Emily does get official immunity and Officer Roney is the only defendant left to go to trial, this would be a jury question to apportion damages. The jury should come in and decide, you know, given Mr. Walter's testimony and given our expert testimony, which portion of the injury that Officer Roney caused and which portion that Officer Emily caused. But dismissing this case altogether simply because there are two defendants and one of them gets official immunity, in our view, was an error. I'm out of time here, so I'll respond during my rebuttal.
All right, and you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Goodwin. You may proceed. You need to unmute yourself. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just had to raise my podium a little bit.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court and counsel. My name is Michael Goodwin, and I am representing the respondents in this matter. This is a case in which the plaintiff simply doesn't have enough evidence to create a jury question on any of his claims.
Well, could we talk about the issue of whether the appellant here has to show conduct that's malicious or sadistic, or if it's just a deliberate indifference standard that should be applied?
Sure, Your Honor. So we believe it is the malicious and sadistic standard. Ultimately, we don't think it matters. But I'll first go through the why we think it's malicious and sadistic, and then why we don't think we think the outcome.
Well, why isn't this just a condition of confinement? And this is one of, in order to provide the life necessities that this appellant and other prisoners have to be in hand restraints once in a while, and there's certain conditions and policies as to what type of restraints they need or should be provided when they go to medical appointments. Why wouldn't that fall under just a condition of refinement and a necessity of their life in prison?
I think the issue is how long the decision at issue for Eighth Amendment purposes is how long Mr. Walters was restrained in cuffs. That's the discretionary decision pursuant to DOC policy, and I'm looking at the respondent's addendum, page 21. The reason that that's evaluated under a use of force standard is the officer who made the decision to keep him in restraints said he was doing it for his own safety because he was the only officer there, and there were two inmates there. And he said, "I don't feel safe when I'm alone with two inmates." That's his deposition testimony. So because you have a situation where the officer is applying the restraints for his own safety and to preserve institutional order, that is squarely controlled by the standard in Jackson versus Gutsmer, for example. I would also note, Your Honors, that as the plaintiff has framed this complaint, he's relying on the use of force policy at the DOC, and that's yet another reason why this should be treated as a use of force incident and evaluated under the.
Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, as I read it, those policies sort of go to the question of the official immunity issue. I mean, the preliminary question of whether it's a use of force standard or a deliberate indifference standard, I think, is not necessarily measured at the point that there's discretion in the holding area. But I think what the argument is by the appellant here is it's from the very start, you know, the moment that you have to look at the moment that the person is restrained for the purpose of the medical transport, which the argument is it was done, you know, too tightly here, et cetera. And then when, and that's the problem that led to the injury. But you evaluate that from the start of whether there's actually a safety concern at the start, as opposed to just a condition, I guess, of confinement, which I think is what Judge Hooten is referring to. So if you back it up from, you know, the testimony that I had a safety concern to the immediate moment of where he was first restrained, how does the court determine what tells us what standard of legal standard applies at that moment? Why should it be a use of force standard when there has not yet been expressed concern relative to that inmate about his safety or risk to safety, I should say?
Your Honor, I don't think that the inquiry or the decision about what standard this court applies turns on the specific concerns related to that inmate. It's evaluated from the officer's perspective. In the Eighth Amendment, there's both a subjective and an objective component. In this case, if you look back at the decision to apply the cuffs in the first place, Officer Roney did not have any discretion whatsoever to not apply the cuffs. It's required by DOC policy. After Officer Roney completes the transport, and I'll point out that Officer Roney, even assuming that he didn't double lock the cuffs, Officer Roney manifests his belief that that it's going to be a very short period of time and it'll be fixed later. After Officer Roney completes the transport, however, Officer Roney is no longer a decision maker for purposes of the use of force analysis. Oh, all of the decisions.
Would you agree that the policy that requires Officer Roney to double lock the handcuffs is a ministerial duty that's imposed upon him by the policies of the DOC?
We do agree, Your Honor, that double locking is a ministerial duty for purposes of this case. Yes. The court does have to look for purposes of the constitutional claims. The court has to look at the conduct of the individual actors. Officer Roney.
In that, yes, we have evidence in this case that that duty was not performed, according to the appellant. And I know that Officer Rooney claims that he did perform the duty. Doesn't that create a fact issue which makes summary judgment at least relevant to that conduct inappropriate?
No, Your Honor, because it has to be a material fact. And even assuming that the handcuffs were not double locked, there's no evidence that the double locking was done with deliberate indifference to a serious medical need. The evidence shows that Mr. Welters asked that the cuffs, he said that they felt a little tight. I believe he also used the words a little snug at the beginning. That's what he said to Officer Roney. Roney says, well, it's only going to be a short transport, and manifests his belief it, you know, we'll fix this later. For whatever reason, that doesn't happen, but it's no longer Officer Roney's decision. At that point, it's Officer Emily who makes the decision to continue the use of restraint. There's no evidence in the record that Officer Emily was told that plaintiff was in substantial pain.
Well, could I mean, looking at this matter, sure, in the light most favorable to the appellant here, which is what we're required to do, right?
Yes.
Apparently, Welters told Officer Roney that the right handcuff was now too tight and it needed to be fixed. So, and he told him that before they did the 15-minute trip over to the other facility for the medical appointment. Isn't that enough to get this matter before a jury? And
no,
out of a summary judgment, because it's I mean, it's a ministerial duty, apparently, according to the appellant. It wasn't performed, and what he did do was done inappropriately. And he complained. He said it needs to be fixed. It's too tight. I mean, what?
So.
And then he's got a doctor's report that says as a result of wearing these too tight handcuffs for for 3.5 hours, that he developed carpal tunnel. Why isn't that sufficient to get, to get past a summary judgment motion?
So, Your Honor, I'd like to answer your question both with respect to the Eighth Amendment claims and then move on to the negligence claim because there are some different issues there. First, under the Eighth Amendment, even under the deliberate indifference standard, what the plaintiff has to show is that he was deliberately indifferent to a substantial risk of harm. And the plaintiff also has to show that a reasonable officer would have known that the failure to double lock for a short period of time put the plaintiff at a substantial risk of harm. There's no evidence in the record that would show that. And in fact, the evidence cuts the other way. Roney says it's only going to be a short transport. Roney doesn't believe that there's a substantial risk of harm. And then the decision maker becomes Officer Emily. Emily is never told that plaintiff is in pain. He's asked to remove the cuffs, but he's not told these cuffs are hurting me. There's no case law that puts either officer on notice that this is creating a substantial risk of harm to the plaintiff. As to the negligence claim,
I do want to hear your negligence answer because I have that same question, but I just want to back up for 1 second before you turn there. You say he didn't believe there's a substantial risk of harm. I mean, when we're in the constitutional realm, we're looking at whether a reasonably competent officer would believe, right, that they are violating a clearly established right by not attending to an inmate's claims that they are being harmed. Isn't that, I mean, what is a subjective belief? Does a subjective belief matter at that point?
Yes, Your Honor, because the Eighth Amendment has both an objective standard and a subjective standard.
Is that true under the deliberate indifference standard?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
It's true. Deliberate indifference has both the objective and the subjective. The difference between the standards is whether the plaintiff has to show malice.
Now, wasn't Officer Emily's response because it looks like the evidence is that he told Officer Emily that his hands were numb and that he wants to get the restraints off. And the response was he needs to go find his partners. How viewing this evidence in the light most favorable to the appellant, how is that evidence supportive of your claim that Officer Emily didn't know about the concerns? I mean, if he really didn't have a concern about what was going on, why would he need to look for his partners?
So, Your Honor,
I have to view this again in the light most favorable to the appellant. How do you get around those facts?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the testimony, that Mr. Welter's testimony is that he told Officer Emily that his hands were numb. I believe his testimony is that he said, "Why are we still in restraints?" And I think that's at pages 12 and 13 of Mr. Welter's deposition. So I don't think that those are the facts that are in the record. And merely being told that that the offender would like the restraints off does not create a deliberate indifference claim. There's no case law that I'm aware of that supports that.
Because I interrupted you before, I mean, you're moving to negligence. So if we assume that the failure to double lock was a ministerial duty, and then the district court, though, granted summary judgment on the basis of causation, right? And concluded that, I think I know this is summary judgment, so we don't, the district court's not, reasoning is not dispositive, but the district court concluded that the appellant has to establish with credible evidence that Officer Roney's failure to double lock uncoupled with any of the subsequent conduct, was a substantial factor in bringing about his injury, and that the expert's report doesn't do that. I'm wondering about why it should be uncoupled from the rest of it. And I'm also wondering what evidence would one expect? You know, it's not like an expert was there to see, oh, when did it get too tight? I mean, we can, taking everything in light most favorable plaintiff, they were too tight and they created the harm. And, you know, no one was there to say, well, were they too tight exactly from the start or when it was, you know, when it was done wrong? I don't know. It seems like, why isn't that a fact question for a jury?
Sure. And the reason it's uncoupled, Your Honor, is because you're talking about different decision makers. So Roney is the one who for summary judgment purposes, does not double lock the handcuffs. The court assumes that. After the transport, Roney makes no decisions as to the length of time that Mr. Welters is restrained. And all of plaintiff evidence is about of injury is about the length of time. The initial tightness of the cuffs, and I see I'm out of time, but I'd like to finish answering
your question. You may finish, I think I'm going to have another question for you as well.
Okay, so sure. The initial tightness of the cuffs, he says that they feel a little snug or a little tight. But then after that, we're talking about a different decision maker. And I will say one of the cases that that I would suggest supports this is the Hayden versus Nevada County case, which talks about causation, which talks about decisions made by a later decision maker who's immune. That's this case. The initial decision or failure to double lock the handcuffs happens, and then it's a different decision maker making decisions about the continued use of restraints, and the continued use of restraints is what allegedly caused the harm. And so that's what should be uncoupled, as the district court put it, that later decision maker is an intervening cause that supersedes the initial failure to double lock the handcuffs. And I believe Judge Hooten, you said you had another question.
I do, and that's with regard to your discussion of immunity, and you made the point in your briefing that it was a discretionary act as to it's discretionary act as to Officer Emily, whether he did it or whether he, you know, should have removed it or not. And apparently he says, I want to keep those cuffs on for, you know, because I feel like for safety reasons, I want to keep it on when I'm not working with anyone else and I don't have anyone else. Yet I look at the evidence and there is evidence that there was an officer one and an officer two. Apparently, there were two other officers that were, one was in the holding cell and one was in the medical procedure, which I understand was right very close. So there were two other officers around. So how do we assess that evidence in light of the undisputed evidence that there were two other officers around? He wasn't alone.
Your Honor, my understanding of who was where is that Officer Emily was alone when he was in the holding cell with the two prisoners. I believe, I mean, this is at Oak Park Heights, so there are corrections officers. There are corrections officers all over the place. I don't think he meant. And I don't think the evidence supports that he was alone in the facility. I think his testimony is, I was alone in the room with two inmates and I need to go get my partners. That's my understanding of the record.
All right. And the other question I have for you is you know, in looking at this evidence, why there was all of the apparently Officer Emily, as well as these other officers, said we're looking for the officers that brought him over. I presume they were looking for those officers because they had the key to the handcuffs. Is that a fair presumption? Because apparently Officer 2 says I'm looking for them. Officer 1 said I'm looking for them. Apparently another Officer Emily says I'm looking for them. I mean, that was their response. So they weren't discounting what they were being told and what they were being asked, but they were looking for the other officers. Am I correct on that evidence?
So
they were looking for the officers that brought them over, because I assume you have a separate key for each pair of handcuffs. Am I correct on that? Or
I'm not sure of the answer to that question, Your Honor. I'm not sure exactly why the officers were looking for the officers that brought them over, whether it was for the key or just because those are the officers who kind of have responsibility for those inmates. So I'm not sure I can answer that. And I'm not aware of a record site for you either that would answer the question. So I do know that the testimony is that the officers, they were trying to find the officers, but I'm not sure why.
And do the policies also require that people, that prisoners not be restrained any more than necessary? So there's a clear policy that, and certainly not be restrained in any manner that would cause them harm. Isn't that also part of the duties of the officers when they're making these transports?
I think there is a statement to that effect in the policy, Your Honor, but it does make that decision discretionary, and that's where immunity comes in.
All right, thank you. Any other questions from either of my panel members? All right,
thank you, Your Honors.
Oh, Judge Smith?
No, I do not have questions.
Oh, all right, thank you. All right, Mr. Lederman, you may have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to first go to the issue as to what Mr. Walters told Officer Emily at Oak Park Heights. Testimony is on page 113 of Mr. Walters' deposition. This is Exhibit 1 to our summary judgment record. And he states, I told him my hands were numb. So that's a deposition statement. So if the court wants to see what exactly he reports having told Officer Emily, that's where Your Honors can find that. I want to respond quickly to the argument by counsel that this is an issue, that the negligence claim and the causation issue is governed by this intervening cause doctrine. That's not the case here, Your Honors, for two reasons. First of all, we have this contributing cause doctrine as well. In our view, Officer Emily's negligence in removing the cuffs when they got to Oak Park Heights contributed to Mr. Walter's injury, as opposed to intervened in some other way that, you know, kind of takes Officer Roney out of the picture. And the second issue is that Officer Roney didn't loosen the cuffs or fix them when they got to Oak Park Heights either. So it's not the issue of only the transportation and then all of a sudden he's no longer there. He brought him to Oak Park Heights. He knew that the cuffs were tightening. He knew they were in double lock, and he didn't fix them even when they got there. So this is, if anything, once again, this is an issue for the jury to figure out who's responsible for what, and not a proper claim to dismiss on summary judgment.
Did the judge deal with this issue of intervening causation?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Or was it raised below?
I don't believe it was raised, and the judge didn't really address it. The judge just saw this as more of an issue of how do we prove specifically that Officer Roney caused the injury. And that's kind of how the district court looked at it. And it's also important to remember that, you know, that this is not a case where we're talking about discomfort. You know, this is not a case where Mr. Walters claims that, you know, he suffered some temporary discomfort while he was handcuffed longer than he should have been. The principal claim here is nerve damage. What caused the nerve damage? And we have more than sufficient evidence to show that the failure to double lock the cuffs is exactly what caused the nerve damage. Because if they were double locked, Mr. Walters perhaps would have been uncomfortable during the procedure, but there's a good chance that he wouldn't have suffered any nerve damage. So Officer Roney, again, is responsible for the double locking, and his failure to do so continued to cause the injury throughout the medical procedure.
Did we talk about Officer Emily? Because Officer Emily says, basically, if I had to paraphrase, this was a discretionary act. I didn't take them off because I was concerned for my own safety and the safety of others. And how do you respond to that? He's making that assessment that there, it's a safety issue. And don't the policies allow that discretionary decision to be made?
Right. So the policy does indicate that the cuffs should not be applied longer than necessary. Number one, in the policy, that this is the use of force policy. It also talks about that the cuffs should not be used in a way that causes any sort of pain or suffering. The policy also talks about the fact that inmates should be remain under supervision while they're cuffed, and that officers should respond to it. So is there some level of discretion? Yes, but if we also look at this policy in conjunction with Captain Matthews' memorandum that he wrote to Mr. Walters, now I deposed Captain Matthews, so I'm aware that he backtracked on all of that memorandum, and he basically testified that what he wrote in there isn't the case. But we do have the memorandum in which he writes that officers should always remove the cuffs upon arrival at Oak Park Heights, unless there is a security concern. And so if we look at the policy and we combine that with that memorandum that Captain Matthews wrote, in our view, there is a fact dispute here as to whether the duty to remove the cuffs once the inmates get to Oak Park Heights, whether that's discretionary or ministerial. And once again, if there is a fact dispute, a jury should resolve that, because it appears based on Officer Captain Matthews' memorandum that the officer should have known to remove the cuffs. And he reminds them again to always remove the cuffs when they get to Oak Park Heights. And again, this is the highest security prison in the state. There was simply no security concern anymore when Mr. Walters got there. I'm out of time, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. And I know the respondent had a few additional minutes. So any questions from anyone on the panel?
I do not.
All right. Since there's no questions, we will take the matter under advisement. It's a very interesting question, and it's well